So it's become a bit of a tradition at Dabayagiri that after monks go tudong, they give a Dhamma talk. We heard that from Tan Kovilo and Tan Subhajo earlier on. And this is, I remember I usually like tudong talks because you never quite know what you're going to get. But personally, I basically can't go tudong because of my knee problems. But Tan Subhajo and I did something a bit unusual for this community. I guess it would have been starting almost 2 weeks ago on Sunday. So we had been invited to the City of 10,000 Buddhas and Dharmaram Buddhist University to, in a way, the invitation was a bit open-ended. We didn't quite know what was going to happen. The idea for it had come up at the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage when I met Venerable Jinshuan while they were hosting the bicycle pilgrims at the City of 10,000 Buddhas last year. And our ideas, I talked with him on and off through the fall and into December, and the ideas morphed around. I could see he was getting a lot of input about what sort of visit it might be. The original thought had been to teach something about Vinaya or monastic, what it's like to be a monastic. But Venerable Jinshuan is a monk at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, and I believe he's just senior to Tan Subhajo, so I think he's probably completed 5 vasas. But he's actually much more experienced than that, because they spent a long period of time as novices at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. I think for him it might have been nearly 4 years. And then he had spent a long time living at the City of 10,000 Buddhas as a layperson. So I believe he began living there in 2005. So that's before I came to Abhayagiri. But I've known Venerable Jinshuan for even longer than that. We participated in the Dharmaram Buddhist youth activities back probably as early as 2002, maybe 2001, but we both attended the Sharangama Sutra study in 2003 at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. I attended 5 weeks, and I think Venerable Jinshuan attended all 9 as a layperson. So we've known each other for quite a while. It's been a good friendship. And so that was part of where this invitation came from. What the invitation ended up morphing into was to help Venerable Jinshuan, who one of his titles right now is chaplain of the Dharmaram Buddhist University, and he works in their campus life department. And to help their campus life department bring a sort of a Buddhist perspective to campus life. And what could they learn from Abhayagiri? We did some planning ahead of time. Tan Subhajo and I scouring the suttas for various topics they were interested in, and Venerable Jinshuan talking with some of his elders. But yeah, and I'll try to weave some themes together here, but just chronologically, we arrived at the Sudanist Center last, not the Sunday almost a week ago, but Sunday almost 2 weeks ago. The Sudanist Center is basically, it's a property in Ukiah that the City of 10,000 Buddhas, Dharam Buddhist Association, purchased probably over 5 years ago now. I think maybe, and it used to be a Catholic, I think they had nuns there, but then its most recent incarnation was a school for troubled youth, and then it stood vacant for a while, but it's just the sort of property that Dharma Realm Buddhist Association likes to buy. They buy fixer-uppers and do a lot of work fixing them up. Right now, it's the male dorms, and it's where Venerable Jinshuan lives, so they commute about 20 minutes back and forth to the Dharma Realm Buddhist University campus at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. So we arrived there, settled in, talked a bit to Venerable Jinshuan. But then, yeah, the next morning, breakfast, that evening, one thing we did very consistently, and it's a hallmark of Dharam Buddhist Association, is morning and evening puja. We call it puja, I think. They call it morning and evening. Yeah, they're morning and evening ceremonies. They're longer than our chanting. They're basically an hour each. And it's a combination. And so that was what we did the first night. Sunday night was evening chanting, drawn from all sorts of Mahayana sutras. And I think the liturgy is pretty old. The commentary in the book, the commentary that explains the liturgy, I think, was written by a Chinese monk in the 1700s. So old. So we did that, and then in the morning you get up and do their morning ceremony, which is the same morning ceremony we were doing, and almost the same evening ceremony we were doing each day of that 2003 Sharangama Sutra study retreat. But at the Sudanist Center, they do everything in English. And in their morning chanting, half the time they do the Abhayagiri morning chanting only in English. So they've borrowed that from us. So after a breakfast offered by the DRBU students, we headed to City of 10,000 Buddhas and arrived at part of our project was we wanted to see what the university was like, so we attended three classes. I've never been to a DRBU class. Tansu Hajo has been to some on his Tudong last time. The first class was Buddhist hermeneutics. It was Buddhist hermeneutics 1. So this is the Dharmaram Buddhist University has two tracks. They have a 4-year bachelor's program and a 2 years. I guess 4-year bachelor's program in, they might call it classics. I'm not sure what they write on your degree. It's a great books model. So, but they draw great books from both the East and the West. Venerable Jinshuan said that, Marty Verhoeven said that it's more a great wisdom model is the idea. You don't just pick any texts, but the texts that that embody the wisdom and values that of the founder of that university, Master Xuan Hua, the founding abbot of City of 10,000 Buddhas. So this was, they're small. I think right now it's about 40, maybe 50 students, and so everybody takes the same classes, and so the classes that the Buddhist Hermeneutics 1 was. This is the second semester of the first-year master's students. I think there are about 10, there are about 10 students in the class. Venerable Suhajo and I, and this one was there were two professors for all the DRBU classes. They team teach everything, which I found, I've really enjoyed the team taught classes that I've taken at university. It's a good model. It lets them train the faculty as well. So everybody's in a sense teaching and learning with their model. But Marty Verhoeven was definitely taking the lead that day. And I knew Marty back from, he was the teacher the first week of that 2003 Sharangama Sutra study retreat. So I was like, oh wow, here we are. Both he and I have aged a bit since then. But nevertheless, he was a bit apologetic because the topic of the class was just going, they weren't actually studying any particular sutta that day, but they were going over, basically it's the beginning of paper writing season for the DRBU students, so the students were a bit stressed, and this was the purpose of this class was Marty was going to Marty, Professor Verhoeven, was inquiring with the students about how their papers are going. And the material that they've read was basically all Pali Canon material for Buddhist Hermeneutics 1. And I'm not sure I knew what hermeneutics was before I encountered the names of these classes, and Jinshuan explained it at one point to us at Ubayagiri. Hermeneutics is the study of how you draw meaning out of a text, and at Dharmaram Buddhist University, one of their almost in a way their Buddhist hermeneutics is almost the hallmark classes are almost the hallmark of their university. It's their master's students take three of them, so this was number one of three. The idea is that there's different ways of deriving meaning from texts, which is no surprise. And the most modern universities take a historical approach. You know, how do we, analyzing a text in its historical context, you know, why was it written, you know, who wrote it, why was it written, what was influencing them, you know, what effect did it have, you know, whereas the assignment for the students' papers was more, you know, Professor Verhoeven said, you know, these actually, I mean, you can apply that model to the Pali Canon, and it's frequently done. The scholarly literature is full of it. But the assertion of the class was that the text actually, within itself, the Pali Canon explains how to use it, how to interpret it. And instead of figuring out, and I mean, this is, I don't know that Marty said this, but instead of, you know, the hermeneutics within the Pali Canon, the goal is not to place the Pali Canon in its historical context. The goal is to transform one's own being the same way Siddhartha Gautama, the Bodhisattva and later Buddha, transformed his. So so you interpret the texts that way, rather than historically. And so Marty was asking his students to analyze a bunch of different passages that they had already read. And basically, he didn't give the answer. He was good at, you know, and that may not be the only answer either. He was really good at encouraging students to think for themselves and, you know, asking questions. And Tansu Haju and I stayed silent throughout the whole class. It was about them writing their papers. But we were really impressed with what we heard. Because this is, it's different than what you get it's very different than what you might get at another university that was analyzing these things historically. And the students seemed very engaged. And what they were talking about is more or less what very similar to what Ajahn Tanisaro writes about in his books. And I don't think he uses the word hermeneutics, but for instance, his book Skill and Questions certainly is about the hermeneutics of teaching and learning in the Pali Canon. So we were, I must say, we were both very impressed, and Professor Verhoeven asked at the end, well, you know, you didn't say much. Was this helpful? You know, any impressions here? And we're like, wow, this was amazing, because you're giving these students the time to spend to really dig into these texts in a depth that, honestly, I don't think many of the monks at Abhayagiri have the opportunity to do this, but many of our dedicated upasakas don't have time and guidance to really dig in like this. It's like, wow. You know, I mean, my hope is that the students, I mean, they have to write a paper about it, so they have a definite incentive to think about these things. But if they actually then take what they've learned and start applying it in their lives, well, that would be really transformative, I think. So that I remember we got to lunch late. I think it was Tansu Hajo who finally said, you know, I think we have to leave. Because we were just, so anyway, we had to get our lunch off the, someone had been skillful enough to put food aside on a cart for us. So we had to, the food had already been passed down the monks, so we had to scoop our food off the cart. But I didn't care. It was great. And then after that, we had discussions with Venerable Jinshuan in the campus life office, just about what was going on. And then that evening, we went back to the Sudhana Center, and every Monday night happens to be their dorm dinner night. And so the dorm meets together, all the male students. I think it was about 16 or so students. And they have a topic for discussion. Each person shares a bit. You know, we only had time for about a minute and a half each. But their topic was, and Jinshuan had chosen it because we were coming, their topic was, how does what do you find either useful or challenging about the DRBU Student Code of Conduct? And the DRBU Student Code of Conduct is very different than compared to DRBU, Harvey Mudd College, where I went, had a sort of non-student code of conduct. You know, DRBU is, some of the points are they keep the men and women's dorms are in very different places. The men live at Sudhana Center for the most part, maybe two or three at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And then the women live in, and that's in Great Compassion Hall, which is the men's residence at City of 10,000 Buddhas. And then the women live in houses I've basically never seen and certainly never been in in the women's section of City of 10,000 Buddhas. And the undergraduates have to live on campus. And then while you're on campus, there's other ways of separating the genders. They have, I believe they have separate computer labs for the men and women. There are co-ed common spaces, but in particular the computer labs are separate. There's a couple other, and this is following the usual etiquette at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. I think you also, in general, they discourage sort of pairwise conversations between members of the opposite gender. You need to be back. I forget if it's in the residence hall, or it may even be in your room at 10:30. In paper writing season, the students had asked for, had actually asked for a 9:30 quiet time because they wanted space to write their papers. And there's, yeah, no drugs, no alcohol, anywhere, ever. They eat vegetarian, just like the rest of the, just like the rest of City of 10,000 Buddhas. And there's probably more that I'm forgetting. It's, if you want to read it, it's prominent on the Dharmaram Buddhist University website. They want to make sure that they want to make sure that their applicants know what they're in for. And so the question with these students was, well, how has that affected you? And got, yeah, all sorts of very, very reflective answers, both, you know, both positive aspects and challenges. And then Tansu Haju and I reflected about the same thing with the training rules that we live under. It felt like, I mean, in a way, it was, in a way, yeah, it's a bit of a shared experience, you know, this sense of understanding, right, what it's like to choose to live in a container where oftentimes, you know, you're saying, well, I might want to do that, but I've chosen not to, so I won't. And why you would do that, and what the effects are. And that was part of the reason why Venerable Jinshuan invited us, because he thought that, as you know, the Abhayagiri container seems to work pretty well, and they're still very much developing DRBU. But at the same time, it was very clear that, you know, it's different, because the DRBU students, although they're living a life of sensual restraint now, they're certainly not monastics, and so we also, you know, need to respect that. And so just to see how that worked, Marty Verhoeven, described as freedom from sensuality were the words that Marty used to describe the sort of the Dharmaram Buddhist University vision. You know, what do we do so that, you know, students don't have to worry about getting hit on or, you know, feeling pressure to hit on other people. You know, this whole, just step back from that for some years and then really explore these texts and see how they relate. And evening ceremony and morning ceremony. And then the second class was on the Tuesday class was, this was, I think, Venerable Jinshuan was co-teaching this one, as was someone else. I've forgotten the second professor. Oh, right, he was the second professor was the class was on Western classics, and they happened to be studying the Bible, specifically the Book of John. And I was pretty keen on this. I studied the Bible and read the Book of John years ago. I still found it, I decided at the end of it that, yeah, I still found the Book of John just as challenging as I did 10 years ago. It's, you know, the way I sort of put it to myself is that I'd like to have an easy sort of I'm okay, you're okay relationship with Christians. And the Book of John is one of the books of the Bible that makes that difficult to do. So hence it was, you know, challenging to read it again. But just in a way, just like the Pali Canon, I was able to find, you know, they will find, oh, this is the passage in the Book of John that explains its internal hermeneutics. How does the author of the Book of John want his readers to use that text? So that was interesting, just to notice, hey, I learned something in that first class, and I can apply it. So we talked more in this one, and hopefully we didn't talk too much. The Western classics. This was a different cohort. These were the first year bachelor's students. Class was a bit smaller. And then lunch. And then Tuesday was our first meeting with the campus life staff. At this point, Jin Shuan had, I think, started to use the word consulting for what we were doing, which was, you know, in the beginning, we didn't quite know what we were doing. But this at least, you stick a word on it. So consulting. We can, you know, they have questions. We can answer questions based on our experience. And that was actually fairly... One thing that came out just overall was I was sort of amazed that we had ready answers to many of their questions. And the communication was great because oftentimes we have a Buddhist jargon we use here. The rest of the world does not know a Byagiri Buddhist jargon. But Venerable Jin Shuan and the campus life staff at the City of 10,000 Buddhas have all been in a Buddhist environment for so long that they know our jargon, or if they don't, they can ask really intelligent questions and we can explain it easily in terms that they understand. So communication was really, that was really helpful. We didn't have to translate the way we thought. And our first meeting with the campus life staff focused on the topic of how do they support monastic students who happen to be going to Dharmarang Buddhist University. Master Hua really wanted his monks and nuns to have an education, because I think he saw in China the drawbacks of having uneducated monks and nuns. I'm not familiar with the historical situation, but because Master Hua was keen on it, Dharmarang Buddhist University is keen on it, and in particular, they have a couple of Vietnamese nuns now who are in the bachelor's program, and the woman looking after the women's half of campus life was really, really asking questions about how to support the nuns. And it's a fortunate situation. The nuns, both of them come from, and I forget the community, but it's a community in Southern California, but they both come from the same place, and they have about probably 15 to 20 years in robes. And that's really good, because they can support each other, and they have enough experience in the robes that they can probably make it. But I mean, I must say the writing the papers is tough for them. You know, I'd be like, well, some of us could try to write even Ajahn Yanako and Tan Kovilo, who can speak pretty good Thai. I imagine it'd be difficult for them to write essays in Thai, and it'd be impossible for most of the rest of us. So it's a challenge. But we were able to help and also just reassure them that yeah, okay, it's a workable situation. But also in the future, what are you looking for if a monk or nun wants to apply to the university? What do you look for? How do you support them? So that was I felt like, oh wow, you know, as guest monk, I got to know some of the monks and nuns who are wandering around out there. Good experience. Then back to the Sudhana Center. Evening puja, morning puja. Back to back to DRBU, class number 3, on the Lotus Sutra, taught by Doug Powers, who I also knew from, Doug Powers lectured one of the weeks of the Sharangama session that I didn't attend. But he was around. I knew who he was, and I remember classes from him at the Dharma, Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. But again, you know, looking, well, both of us are older. And yeah, I had read the Lotus. This is the very first time I'd read the Lotus Sutra. And yeah. The Lotus Sutra is different than the Pali Canon. I don't know how many people have read it, but it's sort of mind-blowing. I understand maybe a little bit more about the Lotus Sutra after that class, but it was not, yeah, wow, okay, this is a different way of teaching Buddhism than I'm used to, even though I'd heard some of the stories from the Lotus Sutra because they get told at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And then this time we stayed on campus, and because they were interviewing potential faculty members, and so we did the evening ceremonies on campus at City of 10,000 Buddhas, and then went to back to the DRBU buildings and listened to a lecture called The Contested Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Professor Sean Kerr, he's visited Byaguri before. He knew three of the monks here by name, and we'd seen him briefly earlier that day. And he gave, he talked about the discussion about vipassana, about samatha and vipassana, and it has been going on for a very long time. And then talked about recent scholar practitioners who are weighing in on the debate, and gave a perspective on samatha and vipassana, which is again very close to what Ajahn Jeff writes about, that one develops insight by seeing the drawbacks of the pleasure generated by skillful samatha practice, basically the jhanas. And instead of explaining it from sort of a practice point of view, he looked through the suttas in a fairly sort of academic manner. And I think you have to downplay your investment in things in terms of practice, which is, it's again this analytical, the normal analytical hermeneutic, where, in a way I was thinking, it's called the academy, and there's academics who study things, but another meaning of the word academic is meaning basically not practical, divorced from regular life. This is of only academic interest. And sadly, sometimes that's what it becomes, where you sort of have to hold your topic at hand, hold your topic at arm's length. And it was, I think many of us in the audience, well, we had some suspicions, because Sean showed up here and actually has taken Goenka retreats and that sort of thing, that, Sean, that Sean Kerr had some experience from the practice side as well, which I think after the talk, Tansu Hajo went to talk with Sean, and I found a couple of the people at the, you know, a couple of DRBU people, and explained, you know, that we thought this was really good, and hopefully, who knows, maybe he'll be on the faculty. But that's sort of the combining of the textual and the practice approach seems like what DRBU is looking for. So back to Sudhana Center, had some late night discussions with Venerable Jin Xuan. He had to close the doors, and you know, so we didn't violate the residence rules about keeping quiet. You know, as the monks yakking away while the students tried to write their papers. And then, yeah, morning ceremonies back to DRBU. This time we decided to give ourselves a break from the classes there. I guess Sean was attending one of the Chinese classes that we might have attended, and the professors thought that one visitor was enough, three would be too much, and that's great. And it worked out well, because at this point we had a list of topics to cover in our second session with the full campus life staff that afternoon, and we needed to prepare. So Tansu Hajo and I both worked on our homework. And so the topics, and then we had a second meeting with campus life. And the topics that their questions were about, particularly, their questions were about, let's see, I mean, Venerable Jin Xuan wanted to know more about the process of ordination and how we support junior monastics at Abhayagiri, because he really wants to reinvigorate the Western monastic presence at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Master Hua was very keen to teach Westerners the Dhamma and to have, you know, Americans ordain. And when Master Hua was living, and that was until the City of 10,000 Buddhas was acquired in the 73-74 probably. Master Hua died in 1995. Through most of that time, most of the monks and nuns at the City of 10,000 Buddhas and at the umbrella Dharma Realm Buddhist, at the umbrella organization, Dharma Realm Buddhist University, sorry, Dharma Realm Buddhist Association, they were Westerners. But what happened is Master Hua went traveling in Taiwan and Hong Kong in the early 1990s, and they recognized, wow, this is the real thing. You know, the best Chinese monk doesn't live in China. Or at least that was so they were inundated with very sincere practitioners coming over to practice at the City of 10,000 Buddhas. And then after Master Hua's death, the Western community was a bit shaky, and there were quite a few monks and nuns who left after that. But many of the culturally Chinese Buddhists had a better understanding of what sort of they knew what a Buddhist monastery was like, so they kept it running, but the City of 10,000 Buddhas became, you know, more Chinese oriented, you know, and it's not bad, but it's just hard for a Westerner to go there and try to figure out, what should I do? Where should I be? What does this really mean? I know. And for many of us, when I, like in the early 2000s, when I was going, it was the Dharma Ram Buddhist Youth that provided the doorway to the city of 10,000 Buddhas. So I learned what it all meant and what I was supposed to do. And now perhaps Dharma Ram Buddhist University will do that. But, you know, so that was one conversation, mostly with the Venerable Jinshuan. He was really interested in our confessions, how we handle transgressions of the monastic rules, and also things like our tea time, you know, where, you know, Lumpur Pasano and Ajahn Amaro's, you know, ever faithful attendance at tea time, so that anyone who has questions can go there at 5:30 and ask them, be they monastic or lay. Other topics that we covered with the campus life staff were how to integrate the Noble Eightfold Path into their program. And one thing, you know, and this was, I was working on this as my homework Tuesday or Thursday morning, and the first thing is that they're already doing it. It's just a matter of making, you know, what might not be totally conscious, more conscious. But at the same time, you know, you don't have to be Buddhist to go to attend Dharmaram Buddhist University. And you don't want to make things too Buddhist, because it's like, you know, you don't have to label it, just, you know, practice virtue. And so, you know, there was a bit of that constructive tension, just how do we make sure we're, you know, that these things are in line with the Noble Eightfold Path, but at the same time, not pounding our students over the head with it. And so that was just discussions of, you know, what does right view mean in a university context? Because simultaneously they have an idea of, you know, academic freedom. And, you know, well, right view for them boils down to that, yeah, actions have consequences. And, you know, their action, and so, you know, actions of studying and analyzing a text, and, you know, how you behave in the dorms, and just live your life, they're both actions. They both have consequences. They both matter, and you think about them in the same way. Sort of the integrated approach that they're following. And then, yeah, right intention. Had a discussion of, yeah, how does vegetarianism work for them? You know, the sense that, I mean, it's one thing just not to eat meat, and it's another thing to think about to reflect on that and to recognize, yeah, well, this is an aspect of harmlessness, and to really, really rejoice in that. So we talked about that aspect of their program, and also the renunciation aspect, and their freedom from sensuality, and then also non ill will. How do you get along with each other? Yeah, right speech, right action. Right livelihood. How do they help their students find something to do after Dharma Ram Buddhist University, and navigate a world where, you know, the highest paying careers are not always the most ethical. So there's some choices to make. And yeah, right effort. You know, how do they, working on cycles of, thinking about cycles of procrastination and then frantic effort and then crashing. You know, this is not right effort in the college context, but it was certainly what I observed at college. How do you work with that? And then, yeah, mindfulness. How to pay attention appropriately, and then right samadhi. And one of the other questions was internally, how do you hold that sense of, you know, there's a whole lot of things that you don't do, but there's restraint. But how do you transform that restraint into, again, that sense of freedom from sensuality, as opposed to the sort of grumbling, you know, anywhere from grumbling frustration to just sort of, or breaking the rules, or lashing out, or getting, you know, or sort of sinking into depression, none of which is skillful. How do you live within restraint and hold it as freedom from sensuality with joy? And so this was something where Tansu Hajo and I both talked about in a way that, yeah, right concentration, sense of learning how to brighten the mind, and that brightness of mind, taking delight in one's goodness, taking delight in generosity, taking delight in, you know, wholesome activities with other people, taking delight in service, and then using that sense of joy to settle the mind and to bring forth the Brahma-viharas, goodwill or loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. In a way, that was related to the theme of Sean's talk on Wednesday. It was related to the right concentration of the Noble Eightfold Path. It was related to the questions the students were asking us. We had a tea on, I guess it would have been Tuesday. We had tea with a very few number of students on Tuesday, late Tuesday afternoon, and that was what they were asking. You know, and what we ended up talking about was the Brahma Vihara practice, very practical. So how do you? So now remember, Tansu Hajo and I had an interesting, just very quick exchange where I was, you know, Venerable Chinchuan asked, you know, is meditation essential for this developing of the developing of freedom from, learning to appreciate that freedom from sensuality? And my answer was, well, you know, I find it really useful, but I'm not a devotional type. Maybe devotional ceremonies could do the same thing for someone who was. And Tansu Hajo said, well, I'm not sure that's the same thing, because when you have devotional ceremonies don't give you a chance to reflect on how you're doing. It's more going out. But he continued with, but so I think meditation is essential here, but it doesn't have to be long. It can be 5 minutes. But it matters that you do it regularly, you know, every day. You know, say pick a particular time. And so that was, I thought, and Jinshuan and the campus life staff are taking notes about all of this. And I thought, wow, this is really good what we're doing here. You know, having being able to discuss discuss things like that, work through, and then, you know, and then have actually the discussion be meaningful, because, you know, this will, you know, how right now the program at the Sudhana Center has been, they start their chanting at 5:30, and it's about an hour of chanting, you know, and it's chanting, bowing, reciting while walking, City of 10,000 Buddhas liturgy. And then you go and meditate for an hour. And this works great for Venerable Jinshuan, for Ajahn Kachana, for Tansu Hajo, and for like the other RA, and one student showed up once. But so it works great for us, but it'd be good to find a way to get people together for a much shorter period of meditation that would help the students. So these are, you know, real changes, real ideas. And then finally, we talked about the role of service, because most of the DRBU students are on work fellowship, which means they do, I think it's something like, it might be 10, it might be 13 hours of work a week. But, you know, how do you transform that from, you know, just sort of something I have to do, to an opportunity for service, a way to contribute to this community? And actually, Bayagiri, you know, our work periods do really well at that. And so we talked about the idea, the importance of starting together and ending together, Ajahn Chah's mottos for work. Suggested, hey, morning, you know, we have these books of morning reflections that we read, you know, that we are the recordings of our, the spontaneous reflections of monastics every day before our work period. And it's in Beginning Our Day, volumes 1 and 2. You know, that sort of reflections can be useful. And I think they may already be doing it, but the idea of a big clean, where everybody pitches in and gets and cleans this place, like we do on the day before Wanpra. The monastics clean the monks' dining hall, the monks' dining hall, the Dhamma hall, and wash a vehicle, while the lay people in Anagarikas clean, do a deep clean at the kitchen. And everybody starts together, everybody ends together. You look out for what needs to be done. It's an opportunity for practice, opportunity for service, and opportunity for fun. So I don't know how they'll work with that, but it'd be a different university where everybody, you know, the students, the staff, the professors, you know, for say, you know, 45 minutes on Friday, all stop what they're doing and go through and clean the buildings. That certainly never happened to me at Harvey Mudd College. We had people paid to clean the dorms and clean the buildings, and yeah, there was a sense that, you know, we were the sort of students, and I didn't even recognize that as, I mean, I wasn't even really thinking, at least for the first few years of my college existence, that this was a sort of a class distinction, and I'm a student, you're the janitor, we have different roles, we don't sort of, you know, we don't, you know, there's, yeah, it's a, we're not quite on the same page. And so putting everybody together to work towards a common goal, you know, it's a different measure of efficiency. You know, you might cover, you know, one less text, say, in your class, but have greater communal harmony, and maybe get to the point of what those texts are trying to say and embody it in your life. So that's the... after we came back after that second meeting, and Venerable Suhajo and I were both exhausted. We're not used to such intellectual work full time. Jinshuan must have been even more exhausted, but he wasn't showing it really. The city of 10,000 Buddhist monastics can be amazing at their patient endurance that Master Hua trained them in. But it really let us have a sense of, wow, you know, we're doing something valuable here, because the answers that we were giving that were well received and, you know, carefully written down and were nothing more than really reflecting on what it is we do every day right here. It wasn't anything all that, yeah, nothing other than living at Abhayagiri. And then, I guess, Tansu Hajo and two other monks went on the Ukiah alms round, just like we do every week or so. And the entire MA1 class was out there at Safeway with a whole bunch of food to offer. And I think Tansu Hajo said that Shari Epstein, one of the DRBU professors, was there with the students, and Tansu Hajo asked something like, "Hey, don't you have class?" And the students said, "Well, yes, we do, but we're on a field trip." there you are. Okay, go. You study the texts, and the texts say, giving is good, and then you go and out of gratitude for the monks who, you know, came, and express that in the very traditional way of putting food into the monks' bowls, and then in my mind the real benefit, in a way, what makes it sort of university and in a way education rather than simply doing it, is that then you do that and you reflect on it, the significance of that, you know, what you felt, what the context is, what's going on, and that's really where, so yeah, that sense of deep reflection, do things and reflect on them, whether it be, yeah, studying the texts, cleaning the buildings, offering food, living under rules. It's that reflection that develops the wisdom faculty that Master Hua was very much hoping to instill in his community, and the Dharma Realm Buddhist University hopefully perpetuates that tradition. And Tansu Hajo and I were privileged to participate for a couple of days. And so I'm pretty sure I've gone over the usual amount of Dhamma talk time, so I will leave this for your reflection.
Uh-huh.